Without me, you could not live. I am everywhere. Look about you. I am in your soil, your water, your plants, even in your body. I am in the sun, in the planets, in the stars. I am.
WCCO and Twin City Federal present Minnesota Milestones. Pipestone to Taconite. The story of mining and geology. Look about you. Look at this God-favored land of Minnesota. Look at the rocky cliffs and crags towering over Lake Superior. The Palisades of the Mississippi. Broad prairies of southwest Minnesota. Look to the ranges where the rust red ore lies in the gashed earth. The lakes where once the glaciers stood, freezing the earth in silent hardness through the centuries. Man, busy, energetic man, digs and burrows, explores, and takes all the resources that nature, through aeons of time, has obviously given for our enjoyment or has cunningly hidden away. This is the story of land, Minnesota land, from whence it all came, the story of man's contest with the resources of nature, the iron, the water, the clay, the stone. The story of man and the earth that supports him. I am E.W. Zeebarth.
I am Cedric Adams.
I am Bob DeHaven.
This is the eighth in a series of 12 special hour-long broadcasts in honor of Minnesota's 1958 statehood centennial. This year-long series, presented by WCCO Radio and Twin City Federal, is called Minnesota Milestones. For the next hour, we will explore our state, trying to fathom the mysteries of the ages. There is the exciting story of man's discovery of those secrets nature has stored away in the hills and rocks. This is a story of the Minnesota you see about you as you work, live, and travel. This is Minnesota Milestone. Minnesota, Pipestone to Taconite.
I am iron. I was there when the foundations of the world were laid. I was at white heat and allowed to cool over the millennium. I am iron. I was there when muddy waters rolled in and covered the earth. I am iron. I was there when the mountains thrust their jagged shapes through the watery surface. I was again heated to my melting point, then spewed forth over the land in gigantic volcanic eruptions. I was there when the great seas rolled back and lay silent for countless millions of years. And then the rains came and soaked and drenched and pounded on the rocks, breaking, tearing, wearing them down. I am iron. For eons, I have been tossed, melted, drenched, compressed, twisted, wrenched, folded, and frozen. I lay beneath the glaciers, ice 1,000, 2,000 feet thick. And then as the glaciers edged back, I was scraped across the surface of the earth. And there I lay, still longer, waiting, just waiting.
On the mountains of the prairie, On the great red pipestone quarry, Gitche Manito the mighty, he the master of life descending, on the red crags of the quarry stood erect and called the nations, called the tribes of men together.
Here came the tribes from all over the continent to dig the soft red shale and work it into their pipes of peace. Many are the Indian legends which grew up there in the quarry, down there in the valley of the Big Sioux. One legend, an object lesson in peace for the whole world. A legend as good today as it was then, back there in the dim, unrecorded past of ancient Indian lore.
These three rocks, oh my children, these are the three maidens. Once the warriors of all Indian nations fought with fierce hate. With their tomahawks they fought, and with bow and arrow, and they killed all women and children. And the warriors fought one another, taking scalps to hang on lodgepoles. When at last fighting ended, all were dead, save three young maidens. And here they came, to this quarry, to the refuge of this peaceful valley. Here behind these three huge boulders, they came and hid themselves in terror. And Manitou the Mighty took pity upon these his children. And in each the seed of life he planted. From these three, the Indian maidens, came new tribes. Manitou, replacing the nations, destroyed by hate and fierce fighting.
But the white man, the practical-minded white man, destroyed the Indian legends with his scientific knowledge. The three Indian maidens, the three huge boulders, at one time were one huge rock, a massive boulder, 50 feet in diameter. And back in the Ice Age, the massive weight of thousands of tons of ice pressed down and cracked and split the big rock, breaking it into the three parts you may see today. And the pipestone, that is, catlinite, geologists call it shale, that somehow failed to turn slate hard, as shale has in other parts of Minnesota, remained soft and pliable, easy to carve. The pipestone quarry has been preserved for future generations to see. It's now a national monument. There, 1 mile north of the city of Pipestone, you can see for yourself the three maidens and the scarred, broken rocks where the Indians made their pipes of peace.
I am iron. I am old. I have seen many things. I saw the Indians fashion their pipes of peace. And I saw the white man digging frantically.
Gold! 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 I found gold! I'm rich! I'm rich! I found gold! Just look at this nugget! Gold! Gold!
Hey, let me see. Hey, where'd you find it?
Right here.
They say we ought to sneak out a claim. Come on, let's get going!
Gold! Gold! Gold!
Yes, it was gold. There in the valley of the Zumbro River in southeastern Minnesota. It was a logical spot for a gold mine, all right. The glaciers had never touched the southeastern corner of the state. There the rivers flowed through deep gorges they had cut on the rocky hills centuries before, washing, wearing, crumbling the rock. And the newspapers of the day added fuel to the excitement in the towns of Orinoco and Rochester, the year 1858, 10 years after the California gold rush.
We have been shown by A. Jacobs, Esquire, of this town, a handsome piece of quartz-bearing gold picked up 3/4 of a mile from Zumbro Falls. It contained some $2 worth. The same gentleman also showed us some of the dust gold gathered from the sands of the river.
That did it, and the Orinoco gold rush was on.
And I tell you, the whole bottom of the river is filled with gold, paved with gold. There's a king's ransom in gold. I've seen it. With these eyes, I've seen it. There's a hill of gold, solid gold. All along the Zumbro River, no man knows how much gold.
Each story growing more and more fanciful with each and every telling. It was reported, too, that gold had been found in the country surrounding the Minnesota River near St. Peter, and men flocked there, too. a company was formed, the Orinoco Mining Company, directed by T.A. Olmsted, who himself had been a veteran of the California Gold Rush. 30 stockholders raised enough money to construct a sluicing operation 180 rods long. Though men toiled and sweated and worked and panned, no more gold was ever found in the Valley of the Zumbro. But somewhere in this world, perhaps in some family collection of heirlooms, there is proof that gold was indeed once found in the Valley of the Zumbro. Enough gold, that is, to make 2 waistcoat buttons, and for Rochester jeweler Dawson to make a half dozen wedding rings.
Minnesota had a second gold rush, bigger, more exciting, the Vermilion Gold Rush, bigger, noisier, rowdier than the one at Orinoco. A town was laid out at Winton. There had not been time to acquire all the typical mining town features in the Orinoco Gold Rush, but at Vermilion, shacks were quickly erected and there were saloons and dance halls and faro tables in true Western style.
Sugar, just one little old dollar for a little old drink with a little old me.
Oh, not now, Lily. I want to talk with the boys. This is a big deal we're working on.
Oh, but honey, you're going to be such a big, rich, strong, handsome man. And I just love big, rich, strong, handsome men like you, Sugar. Please, one little old dollar for one little old drink.
You see, you know, out in California, we thought we had it good when we got $6 or $8 a ton. But here, $30 a ton, counting the gold and silver. I tell you, this is fantastic. Ain't never been nothing like this.
Yeah, and I tell you, you know what I heard? Some of them geology fellas was saying there's gold 3 inches to 10 feet thick, and them veins run straight on for miles. Ain't much digging to do neither.
Yes, it was another false alarm, another failure. More excitement over nothing. The disappointed financiers who had sunk their money into gold mining companies hired another geologist who reported in 1880,
"I have collected and examined hundreds of specimens from quartz veins in the Vermilion Lake District, and it's my considered opinion there is no gold in this region. I recommend that all attempts to find gold be abandoned."
I am iron. I could have told them they wouldn't find gold, but nobody asked me. My Uncle Oro, on my mother's side, 30 million generations removed, why, he knows where all the gold is in this world. But nobody asked him. And they didn't ask me either.
In a moment, we'll have the story of Minnesota's real gold mine, the richest find of them all, the story of Minnesota iron ore.
Right now, I'd like a word with all the people who have not struck gold, who do not own a silver mine, who...
Or an iron mine.
Yes, or an iron mine. Why, nice to have you join me, Iron. To what do I owe this pleasure?
I thought I might help you tell the people about Thrift and Twin City Federal.
Well, just...
Through the centuries, I have witnessed the rise of many a successful man.
But,
I have observed the titans of industry. I have...
Iron.
...watched men of small beginnings build magnificent... You look pained, Mr. Adams.
You're standing on my toe.
Sorry.
That's better. You were saying,
I was saying, few men find fortune strewn in their path, but many men gain it through thrift.
Precisely the point I intended to make.
And the place to save?
Twin City Federal, where accounts are insured for safety, where the current dividend rate is 3.5%, where parking is free, and you park right at the door.
You might tell them saving beforehand at Twin City Federal helps iron out difficulties which may arise, Mr. Adams.
Your humor is a bit heavy, Mr. Iron. Let's get back to our story.
For years, for centuries, I sifted slowly to the bottom of the great inland sea. Me and my relatives, billions of us drifting down in the water. And we raised our families on the way down, united with carbons and the oxygens and the silicons. Of course, we irons were the best of the whole lot, if I do say so myself. And we were pressed together, layer upon layer, on the muddy bottom and hardened into rock. And then another of the Earth's mighty cataclysms churned and hurled. And some of us saw the light of day once again. The water was gone, not pressing down on us anymore. But the rains came and washed the Earth back over us. And I don't mind saying that some of the irons who got together with those low-class silicons and carbonates, they just washed away down into the earth somewhere. But we irons, we pure irons, we stayed right there, and we waited.
And the richest pockets and veins of iron ore went for years unnoticed and undiscovered. The person who first discovered iron ore in Minnesota is not known. For centuries, trappers and fur traders and explorers had brought out chunks of the red rock. Tales of mineral wealth in northern Minnesota were told in the log cabins on winter nights as the fires burned low. Governor Alexander Ramsey had heard these stories, and in his message to the second state legislature, January 2, 1860, he reminded the lawmakers,
"And I should like to point to the mineral lands of the Lake Superior region. We hear these mineral lands are not only of magnificent extent, but that ores of both iron and copper are of singular purity."
Governor Swift also reminded the legislature of 1864 of Minnesota's supposed mineral riches. But it was not until Professor Newton H. Winchell made his thorough geological study of the entire state that something approaching a true evaluation of Minnesota's iron ore deposits was made.
That was in the 1880s, and now our story turns to Charlemagne Tower, an attorney for the Eastern mining interests at Pottsville, New York. He had ordered surveys made, surveys which established beyond any doubt there were immensely rich iron deposits in the Lake Vermilion area. But Tower had another concern, and he explained it to the man who directed exploration in Minnesota, George C. Stone.
"George, we know we have iron ore, and we have it in paying amounts. But now our problems are just beginning. Transportation of that ore to Lake Superior is the first one. We simply must have a railroad."
"I realize that, Mr. Tower, but what other problems are there?"
"Well, now, look at it this way. Just suppose you were a member of the legislature, responsible to the people of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Now, you'd feel it's your duty, wouldn't you, to get all the revenue you possibly could from those ore deposits?"
"Yes, I guess I would."
"All right. Now, what we've got to do is make that legislature understand that it'll cost money to build a railroad. I want them to understand that capital will be scared out of the whole business if they slap on a heavy tax."
"And that's my next assignment?"
"That's your next assignment."
It was due to George Stone's efforts that the legislature of 1881 passed an act to exempt iron ore from taxation, except for a token tax of 1 cent a long ton. One half of that was to go to the state and one half to the county. Late the following year, the Minnesota Iron Mining Company was incorporated. Among the charter members of the firm were Tower and Stone. Since a mining property 60 miles from Lake Superior was of very little value without transportation, Stone returned to the legislature to obtain a railroad charter and a contribution from the state to help build it. On December 24, 1874... the Duluth and Iron Range Railroad Company was organized. Tower acquired 17,000 acres of land in the Vermilion Range area at a total cost of $40,000. This was rugged frontier country. As was common in such areas, the methods of acquiring land were not always legally correct. And at last, there was an investigation, with former Governor William R. Marshall appointed a special land agent to investigate alleged frauds in the Duluth Land District. In 1882, the government brought court action designed to cancel alleged fraudulent homestead entries. Marshall told the court that in traveling over 10 or more townships, he did not find one actual settler. A 1,000-acre tract, allegedly obtained by illegal means, later produced 70 million tons of ore. In the spring of 1884, the Minnesota Iron Company was ready to begin. Its railroad was under construction. To supply the immediate need for labor, the company brought from the Menominee Iron region of northern Michigan a colony of Cornishmen and Swedes. They arrived at the town of Sedan on March 17th, and within a month, the miners began work on two pits, drilling by hand and wheeling out the ore in barrows. And when the pits became deeper, derricks were constructed and tackles were rigged to hoist the ore by horsepower. A considerable stockpile of ore was ready when the railroad was finished on July 31st, 1884. It was a great day, a real holiday.
Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, please, this is indeed a great occasion. At long last, a dream has been realized. A dream that began 10, 20 years ago with the discovery of a few pieces of red rock. A dream that began with the plans for a railroad connecting the Vermilion Range with Lake Superior. Ladies and gentlemen, today we, all of us, will aid in fulfilling that dream.
Yes, sir!
We will now load the ore cars, every man, woman, and child in this community. So do the shovels!
News travels slowly here under the earth, but it does travel. And through my millions of silica, sulfide, and carbonate cousins, and all the rest, I have heard that a big change is coming. So, it's another move for me, iron. I've been in what they call the Mesabi Range for 1,000,000 years, give or take 100,000. Well, let it come.
It was in 1888 that geologist Winchell advised John Malman...
Say, John, I've been looking at that cut there where you're running the railroad to Vermilion. It looks pretty good to me.
It does. Well, shucks, Newt, there's lots of that loose, red, powdery stuff around here.
Yeah, I know. But I just have a hunch. I think you ought to sink a shaft there and take a look at it. Might be something.
Well, Newt, your hunches have paid off pretty good for Minnesota Iron so far. I'll see if I can get the company to do it.
Malman did sink a shaft at the indicated spot. The mine never became important. But because Minnesota Iron Company was obviously exploring on the Mesabi Range, that led others to do the same. And there began one of the great family sagas in Minnesota mining history. In fact, the story of the Merritt brothers is the story of the Mesabi Range. And what a story. It was way back in the years right after the Civil War that the father gathered his 7 sons together...
Now, if I don't teach you boys anything else in this world, I want to teach you that there is iron in those hills. I've tramped over every dad-blamed inch of that land. I've seen with my own eyes those outcroppings of rock. It's good, red rock. I don't have much time left, you know that. But you boys, why, you got a lifetime. And there's 7 of you. And if it takes your lifetime, all of you... I want you to find that ore. It'll make you the richest men in the whole state of Minnesota.
And the Merritt boys did as the old man told them. They started out as timber cruisers, looking over the white pine stands for loggers. They became surveyors, not by going to school, but by serving their apprenticeship as chainmen and rodmen for surveyors. They learned how to prospect for ore by watching the crazy dipping of the compass needle. They learned how to map the rims of basins, the ones most likely to contain the big prize, rich hematite ore. They tramped over the rough trails, canoed to likely-looking spots. That quest went on and on for 20 years. Some of their nephews joined them. Such intense effort paid off at last and handsomely. Andrus Merritt himself told the story.
The turning point came upon the 16th day of November in 1890 in what came to be known as the Mountain Iron Mine. Alf and Lon had returned to Duluth, determined once more to lay hands on money to continue the hunt for ore. Ore they were still convinced would be found on the Mesabi Range. A day or two after their return, word reached our office that one of our parties, headed by Captain J.A. Nichols, had struck it rich. Iron ore. 64% pure iron.
After that, success followed success for the Merritts. The next summer, a timber cruiser working for the Merritts noticed red earth turned up by the roots of a fallen tree about 10 miles east of Virginia. A test pit was run, and that was the beginning of the Bewabic Mine. The Merritts discovered ore where Eveleth was later built, and they found it at Hibbing, 20 miles to the west. And the find at Hibbing was the richest of them all, the fabulous Hull Rust Mahoning Mine as we know it today, the largest open-pit iron mine in the world. Further exploration soon showed the Mesabi Range extending from a point near Grand Rapids, west of the Mississippi, to the eastern border of St. Louis County, a distance of nearly 110 miles. And the boom that had set in with the opening of the Vermilion Mines became even more intense. Duluth was the center of mining talk and frenzied speculation, running into the millions of dollars. Railroads were quickly built into the new, fabulously rich Mesabi Range. Mesabi, where the ore lay so close to the surface, it could be dug after stripping back the thin overburden of earth left by the glaciers. On October 17, 1892, the first trainload of the season, 4,245 tons, was shipped from the Mountain Iron Mine. In 1896, the fifth year of mining, Mesabi ore production rose to nearly 3 million tons. In 1901, the 10th year, more than 9 million tons came from 30 mines on Mesabi. The total for the 10 years was 40 million long tons, and Minnesota had become the largest ore-producing state in the entire Union. In a moment, we'll hear how Hibbing was moved, and you'll learn of today's hope for the Iron Range and for Minnesota taconite. You know, thrift, regular saving, is something people do tend to put off, and isn't it ironic?
You called?
No, Iron, I merely remarked that it was ironic that...
Lovely word.
Yes, but you're interrupting me.
Mr. Adams, life is full of interruptions. Life, you might say, is a series of interludes, some pleasant, some not. And the pleasant episodes are strengthened. The unpleasant are eliminated or shortened in proportion as one is thrifty.
Ah, very good, very good. Now, may I say something, Iron?
Your ball, Mr. Adams.
May I say that a warm and cordial welcome awaits all thrifty persons at Twin City Federal. And that welcome includes free parking right at Twin City Federal's door.
Convenient.
It includes insured safety.
Very essential.
And Twin City Federal's consistently generous dividends.
To forge it faster.
To what?
To forge it faster.
To forge what faster?
The link between your life and a brighter life ahead.
Ah, a thrift link at Twin City Federal.
Yes.
A fine thought. Forge a thrift link for yourself at Twin City Federal. And friends, stop in soon, won't you? You're listening to Pipestone to Taconite on Minnesota Milestones, coming to you over your centennial station in St. Paul and Minneapolis, WCCO.
This is iron again. It has happened at last. After 1 million years in the same old place, I'm on the move again. All of a sudden, there was a noise, a most peculiar noise, not like an earthquake at all. I felt myself being lifted through the air and then dropped. Ooh! I seem to be in some kind of a box on wheels. And some of my relatives are here, too. Hey, we're moving. Going somewhere.
Back in 1900, mining was going full blast on three Minnesota ranges. Miners were at work on the hard rock ore of the Vermilion Range, on the looser ores, the fabulously rich ores of Mesabi, and on the newly discovered iron manganese ores of the Cuyuna Range. But it was transportation that troubled the early day mine owners. The immense cost of constructing railroads to lake ports at Duluth, Superior, and Two Harbors, Minnesota. The cost of constructing ore loading docks at the lakefront. And the cost of the ore-carrying freight boats themselves. And control of mining passed into other hands, from the Merritt brothers to the big corporations with capital. Due to these tremendous costs, plus the financial panics of the 1890s, the Merritts lost control of their mining properties to the John D. Rockefeller interests. In 1901, the United States Steel Corporation was organized and assumed control of what had been the Merritt properties. Another pioneer mine operator in Minnesota was Henry W. Oliver at Pittsburgh. He tramped over the corduroy roads and through the woods and swamps to the site of the Mountain Iron Mine. He was so impressed that he leased mining property from the financially hard-pressed Merritts and organized the Oliver Iron Mining Company. He joined forces with the Carnegie Steel Corporation and made an agreement to ship his ore over the Rockefeller railroads and lake vessels. The price of ore in this era of financial panic fell from $4 to $2.50 a ton. Owners of Minnesota ore properties were anxious to sell, and they found the Carnegie-Oliver combination ready to buy. It was in the early 1900s that Carnegie Steel merged with U.S. Steel, establishing the giant iron mining company, which exists on the Iron Range to this day. Suddenly, another well-known Minnesotan appeared with sizable ore lands back in the early 1900s and gave U.S. Steel some anxious moments. He was James J. Hill himself. It began back in 1897 when Hill's Great Northern Railway bought the bankrupt Duluth and Winnipeg Railroad and merged it with the division called the Eastern Railway of Minnesota. Some 10 or 12,000 acres of land went with the purchase. One of Hill's sons, James N. Hill, learned that an old logging railroad was for sale, and he talked with his father about it.
But, Dad, the least you can do is consider this proposition. We can add to our ore-hauling business up there on the Iron Range.
Now, look here, son. I don't want to fool around with a broken-down old logging road.
Well, broken-down old logging roads, as you call them, can be rebuilt into good-paying railroads. Well, you know that if anybody does. And besides, mining rights go with it, and we don't know how much ore there is there.
That's just it. We don't know how much ore there may be on the property. Besides, we're not in the mining business. And under the law, we can't be in the mining business. We're running railroads.
Well, you know, Dad, something strikes me funny about this whole business.
Is that so? And what's that?
Well, the fact that here you've put millions already into railroad and ore properties on the range, and you've never even seen the mines. Well, let's go up there and take a look. I think you'll change your mind.
After much persuasion, the younger Hill did convince his father to take a trip to the range. He saw the huge scar in the earth at Hibbing, the Mahoning Mine, and watched the ore cars, mile-long strings of them, being pulled over his railroad to Duluth. He was impressed, much impressed. James J. Hill proceeded to acquire railroads and ore properties for his Great Northern Railway at an amazing pace. Dummy corporations were set up to get around the legal provision, which said railroads could not own more land than needed for their rights of way. And that's how it was that U.S. Steel found itself suddenly confronted with the powerful figure of James J. Hill, his railroads and 65,000 acres of ore lands. Furthermore, the Steel Corporation found itself paying Jim Hill a handsome royalty for use of his properties and a handsome fee for hauling ore over his railroads. United States Steel did not want to face a big competitor, so it came to terms with James J. Hill. The financial consolidation of mining properties is an important chapter in the history of the Minnesota Iron Range. But so is the population, the people who came to work in the mines. Back in the early 1900s, the days before mechanization, the work was back-breaking. The wind caught the red ore dust and swirled it in choking clouds. After blasting, the ore was broken up by mallets and was loaded into cars by hand shovel. Here was work that few men cared for. In addition, there was the long winter layoff with no work, no income. The peoples from southern Europe had the stamina for this rough existence, but even for them, it was not easy.
And for years, these hardy southern European peoples were the bone, the sinew of the mines. Without them, the ore never would have reached the docks and the great furnaces in Pittsburgh and Gary. But it was back in World War I when manpower became scarce. It was then that the sounds of the pick and the shovel were heard less and less. And more we heard the new sounds, sounds of mechanization.
There came the giant scoop shovel, the huge monster that could fill a carload of ore in a couple of bites in the red earth. At first, there was the huge Malley locomotive, a steam-driven engine of monster proportions, chugging, puffing around and around the terraced sides of the open-pit mines, and hauling long strings of loaded ore cars to the docks of Lake Superior.
So, that's where I am. This is an ore dock. Let's see. Say, as men measure things, this is pretty long. Half a mile at least. What are those men doing? There go my cousins down into a hole. A pocket underneath that ore car. It must hold about 280 tons. Whoops! There I go. I'm in pocket number 384. Say, this is a long dock. Wonder why they put me in here. Could this be the end of my trip? Well, this is nearly as comfortable and dark as being underground again. What's that noise? A big spout. A 36-foot chute lowered toward the water? Am I going down there? Am I going to be covered by water again? I'm not in the water, but I'm out of that big pocket, and there come more of my brothers. We're all together again. This must be the hold of a boat. Must be 20,000 tons of us in here.
20,000 tons sounds like a lot of ore. It is, but it's not a cinder compared to the amount of ore that was underneath the city of Hibbing in 1920. There it was, the city of 15,000 persons, built atop one of the richest deposits of iron ore in the world. Hibbing, hemmed in by the Hull Rust Mahoning Mine, largest open-pit mine in the world, and growing ever wider, ever deeper. And so in the 1920s and early 30s, the townspeople carried out the biggest moving project in Minnesota history, moving the entire town of Hibbing 3 miles south, thus uncovering the priceless deposits of iron ore. The Oliver Mining Company held mining rights and could have evicted everyone from the town. Instead, company officials chose to move everybody, relocate their homes and businesses. Public buildings, institutions, even manhole covers, sewer pipes, and light poles were carted away and set up on the new location. And the total cost to the Steel Corporation and to the townspeople, between $15 and $18 million. And outside of Hibbing is the township of Stunts, often called the richest township in the world. In one corner of that township is located the rich Hull Rust Mahoning Mine. The town council, a small group of obscure men, wielded enormous power. By merely levying a township tax, they could almost bankrupt the powerful financiers, the owners of railroads, banks, industrial complexes, and the Hull Rust Mahoning Mine.
The visitor to the Iron Range cities noticed at once the spick and span neatness, the newness, broad paved streets, beautiful new schools. With the mines and huge iron ore reserves as a tax base, Iron Range Town supplied themselves with waterworks, sewers, good fire protection, electric lights, intercity street railroads and bus lines, concrete paving, community houses, parks, and libraries. And all of these improvements came at a time when other towns of comparable size were struggling desperately to rise from the cobblestone or the dirt street, the wooden sidewalk era. Over the years, Minnesota's Iron Ranges have supplied the steel for armaments in two world wars. During World War II, production of iron ore in Minnesota reached an all-time peak of 90 million tons in 1 year. For 70 years now, the ores of Mesabi and Vermilion and Cuyuna have supplied the steel for American industry, for the skyscrapers that tower in cities all across our land. And the days of 50%, 60%, 64% pure iron, the days of high-grade iron ore may be numbered. Minnesota must look to the future, to other mineral resources, and to its immense, almost limitless reserves of low-grade ore called taconite rock. In a moment, we'll hear the plans for the future as Minnesota prepares for new progress in the 100 years to come. Talk about your future. Let's take a long look at your dreams, your hopes, your ambitions. Will the years ahead find you enjoying them? Why not? When the power of thrift is available to almost everyone, people with incomes of all sizes are saving for the future, proving every day that small sums become large sums when you save regularly at Twin City Federal. People from all over the Northwest are cashing in on the current 3.5% dividend rate. That's compounded quarterly, too, you know. And that also is the top rate in town on insured savings. People in the Twin Cities like the handy free parking right at the door. Others prefer to save by mail. It's convenient, it's safe, and it's fast. Now, if you'd like save by mail information, tell you what I wish you'd do. Write to me, Cedric Adams, WCCO, personally. Then if you'd like to drive down, look for the twin clock flashing the time and the temperature in either downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul. Would you like an easier future? Easy do? Save regularly with Twin City Federal, the $250 million savings institution, where the twin clock flashes the time and the temperature. But start soon, won't you? The future won't wait.
The combined income of all mining in Minnesota does not equal that derived from the production of iron ore, but there are other mineral resources that are vital to the state's economy.
The United States Bureau of Mines lists the sand and gravel industry as second in value in Minnesota. Sand and gravel operators, however, in this day of rapidly expanding population, of suburbs pushing out farther into the countryside, find themselves facing this situation.
You have the signatures and the petition before you. 1,000 of them. Now that should make it clear to this council how we feel. The gravel pit is dangerous to the lives of our children. It's unsightly. It's a public nuisance.
Well, now you haven't answered my question, Mr. Johnson. Our gravel pit was located there first, long before there were any houses anywhere around. Why did you build where you did? You knew there was a gravel pit in the area where you built.
I didn't answer your question because I don't have to. I'm not on trial here. You are. You're the one who's running heavy trucks and noisy machinery right in the middle of what is otherwise a fine residential area.
Cut it out. I can't.
So, one by one, the big gravel pits are shutting down, are being filled, and the land is being converted to other uses. And yet, the need for washed, clean, scientifically screened sand and gravel is greater than ever before.
Minnesota is blessed, too, with an abundance of granite of superior quality and texture, providing the basis for a thriving quarrying industry.
Early immigrants from Germany established another industry based on Minnesota's underground resources. The first pottery in Minnesota was made by Lewis Kempf in 1857. He established the St. Anthony Pottery Works near the Mississippi in what is now northeast Minneapolis. The famous pottery industry at Red Wing began back in 1878. And again, it was a German immigrant, Joseph Pohl, who realized that the rich clay from pits near Goodhue made a high-grade pottery. Perhaps the best-known piece of Red Wing stoneware in existence is the famous Little Brown Jug trophy of the Minnesota-Michigan Football Classics, dating back to 1903.
Where am I now? What's been happening to me? Somehow, I was rudely dumped into this large container with a hole at the top. It's hot in here. So hot, I've been melting. Hey, what now? I'm being blown up into the air again. I'm floating, no? Now I'm drifting down again. All these others rubbing and pushing me. Now it's happening again. How strange. I wonder why they're doing this to me. Now it's getting cooler in here. And I'm getting solid again. But somehow, I feel different. I'm joined to others in here. I am different. You'd call me steel.
The supply of high-grade iron ore in Minnesota is being depleted, and so in order to maintain our historical position of providing the ore for the production of about 65% of the nation's iron and steel, Minnesota has begun to develop its low-grade resources. Low-grade, but practically limitless iron ore, the mineral resource of the future.
Hello there. I'm Taconite. I'm available. For years, I've been pushed around, ignored, snubbed, not only by man, but as you've heard, by my nearest relative, Pure Iron. I've been around as long as he has, and there's much more of me. At last, I'm coming into my own. I've waited just under the surface of the earth, waited for someone to find me, to learn to use me. And then, one day not so long ago, a man drilled a hole. Hear that? That's a jet piercer, and it's drilling a hole 40 feet deep in our very hard rock bed. It uses burning fuel oil and oxygen at 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit to melt the rock. Too hard for ordinary drills. There are some men about to set off an explosive in a hole that's just been bored. Listen. After a few of those, the big shells come out. Loading 45 tons of us into each big truck, taking us to the crusher at the mine. The body of the truck is tipped sideways, pouring its load of taconite into the crusher. And what a crusher. Big wow. Oh, the one I met at Babbitt, Minnesota, can handle 35,000 tons in 1 hour. And that's processing. After we're ground down to shipping size, and that's about the size of a fist, we're dropped from a high tower into ore cars, a stream that may stretch more than a mile along the tracks. Of course, being taconite, less than 50% pure iron, about 2/3 of what's in those cars is waste. Today, ore trains are hauled by Mallee engines. Oh, not real Mallees, of course. At least not most trains, but by two diesels hooked together that railroad men like to call Mallees. It takes two diesels to do the work of one of those powerful old steam engines. I was hauled by a real Mallee. It carried 25,000 gallons of water, 26 tons of coal. I'll never forget the sound of its whistle. Eventually, taconite is beneficiated further, ground to a powder finer than a fine lady uses to take the shine from her nose. The powder is washed and magnetized, the pure ironiness sticking to the magnets, then formed into pellets and shipped to the blast furnaces of Pittsburgh and Gary.
Just a second, Miss Taconite. Let's find out how it all began.
The story of Taconite is the story of E.W. Davis, known throughout the industry and throughout the state as Mr. Taconite. As head of the University of Minnesota's Mines Experiment Station until he retired in 1955, Professor Davis devoted his lifetime to taconite, and he became interested in the problem in a rather roundabout way.
Well, the idea started with a man by the name of Mr. John G. Williams, who had some property up here on the Mesaba Range that contained magnetic taconite. He was a regent of the university, and I was a young member of the staff. The iron oxide existed in this taconite rock in very minute particles of the oxide magnetite, and the problem was to extract this from the rock in a pure enough state so that it could be used in modern steelmaking practice.
But Dr. Davis had to wait for years, wait for technical improvements in the industry to catch up with the methods he developed in the laboratory. He urged the building of a pilot plant at Babbitt where he could experiment with the conversion of taconite on a commercial scale. Long years passed, and even then, when at last he and his method perfected, there remained another hurdle.
Ad valorem tax. The ad valorem tax is a tax on the value of the material that remains in the state. As long as it remains in the state or the taxing district, the owner is compelled to pay taxes on it. It took a lot of talking and explaining and took a lot of help from various different people in order to get them themselves to come and ask the Minnesota legislature to pass a law prohibiting them themselves from taxing taconite.
The legislature passed the Act of 1941. It was known as the Taconite Tax Law. In 1951, the Reserve Mining Company, which is owned jointly by Armco Steel and Republic Steel, let contracts for the re-equipment of the old taconite pilot plant at Babbitt. Then Reserve Mining proceeded to build its huge taconite processing plant at Silver Bay on Minnesota's North Shore. That plant is named the E.W. Davis Works in honor of Professor Davis.
That's where I am now. Remember me? Pure iron. I'm part of a piece of steel now. And all of us irons, pure irons, that is, we're all moving together, moving all the time. I know what I'm doing now. I am part of something you men call a taconite processing plant. And am I happy? Why, I'm happier than I've been in my whole life. Every single day I meet some of my iron relatives I haven't seen in millions of years. They're coming by here all the time. Hi, Cousin Magna Farrell. I haven't seen you since the last cataclysm. Have a good trip, ferrous oxide, old friend. You'll be seeing some things you've never seen before.
All 12 of the E.W. Davis Works production units went into operation in 1956, Where once there was a wilderness, there now stands two huge plants at Babbitt and Silver Bay. Where once there was rocky soil and brushland and trees, there are now homes and paved streets and stores, churches, all the signs of a new industrial growth. And Dr. Davis lives there too, on the North Shore at Silver Bay.
Just a few years ago, it was a wild wilderness up there. No one lived in the place. So I get a great thrill out of it in the evening by hearing the voices of the children and the dogs that they have with them all over that area. It's just grand. I can't think of anything more satisfactory in a person's life than to be able to work for many years on a project and then live to see it put into usefulness and operation and furnish a livelihood for a lot of people and a lot of children.
Babbitt and Silver Bay are but the beginning. Even now, the big steel companies are being urged to build and develop more taconite plants to add to their present iron ore processing facilities. A second plant, the Erie plant, has gone into operation at Taconite Harbor. And United States Steel has a third plant, a pilot operation, ready for use. Geologists know there is enough taconite ore to keep the plants busy, to keep the ore cars rolling and the ships plowing the waters of the Great Lakes for another 100 years. And even as northern Minnesota seeks to diversify with new enterprise and new industry, with forest products, with new uses for its vast supplies of peat, its hope over the years still lies with its greatest resource, with its billions of tons of low-grade iron ore, refined, processed, concentrated, still feeding the great furnaces at Pittsburgh and Gary. And here, in Taconite, lies the new hope, the Minnesota milestone of the future.